Chapter 2: The Ecological Crisis as a Crisis of Character. Wanting good government in their states, they first established order in their own families. Wanting order in the home, they first disciplined themselves. Confucius, The Great Digest. In July of 1975, it was revealed by William Rood in the Los Angeles Times that some of our largest and most respected conservation organizations own stock in the very corporations and industries that have been notorious for their destructiveness and for their indifference to the concerns of conservationists. The Sierra Club, for example, had owned stocks and bonds in Exxon, General Motors, Tenneco Steel Companies, having the worst pollution records in the industry, Public Service Company of Colorado, strip mining firms with 53 leases covering nearly 180,000 acres, and pulp mill operators cited by environmentalists for their poor water pollution controls. These investments proved deeply embarrassing once they were made public, but the club's officers responded as quickly as possible by making appropriate changes in its investment policy. And so, if it were only a question of policy, these investments could easily be forgotten, dismissed as aberrations of the sort that inevitably turn up now and again in the workings of organizations. The difficulty is that, although the investments were absurd, they were not aberrant. They were perfectly representative of the modern character. These conservation groups were behaving with a very ordinary consistency. They were only doing as organizations what many of their members were and are doing as individuals. They were making convenience of enterprises that they knew to be morally and even practically indefensible. We are dealing, then, with an absurdity that is not a quirk or an accident, but is fundamental to our character as people. The split between what we think and what we do is profound. It is not just possible, it is altogether to be expected, that our society would produce conservationists who invest in strip mining companies, just as it must inevitably produce asthmatic executives whose industries pollute the air, and vice presidents of pesticide corporations whose children are dying of cancer. And these people will tell you that this is the way of the real world. They will pride themselves on their sacrifices for our standard of living. They will call themselves practical men and hard-headed realists. And they will have their justifications in abundance from intellectuals, college professors, clergymen, politicians. The viciousness of a mentality that can look complacently upon disease as part of the cost would be obvious to any child, but this is the realism of millions of modern adults. There is no use pretending that the contradiction between what we think or say and what we do is a limited phenomenon. There's no group of extra intelligent or extra concerned or extra virtuous that is exempt. I cannot think of any American whom I know or have heard of who is not contributing in some way to destruction. The reason is simple. To live undestructively in an economy that is overwhelmingly destructive would require of any one of us, or of any small group of us, a great deal more work than we have yet been able to do. How could we divorce ourselves completely and yet responsibly from the technologies and powers that are destroying our planet? The answer is not yet thinkable, and it will not be thinkable for some time, even though there are now groups and families and persons everywhere in the country who have begun the labor of thinking it. And so we are by no means divided, or readily divisible, into environmental saints and sinners. But there are legitimate distinctions that need to be made. These are distinctions of degree and of consciousness. Some people are less destructive than others, and some are more conscious of their destructiveness than others. For some, their involvement in pollution, soil depletion, strip mining, deforestation, industrial and commercial waste is simply a practical compromise, a necessary reality, the price of modern comfort and convenience. For others, this list of involvements is an agenda for thought and work that will produce remedies. People who thus set their lives against destruction have necessarily confronted in themselves the absurdity that they have recognized in their society. They have first observed the tendency of modern organizations to perform in opposition to their stated purposes. They've seen governments that exploit and oppress the people they are sworn to serve and protect, medical procedures that produce ill health, schools that preserve ignorance, methods of transportation that, as Ivan Illich says, have created more distances than they bridge, and they have seen that these public absurdities are, and can be, no more than the aggregate result of private absurdities. The corruption of community has its source in the corruption of character. This realization has become the typical moral crisis of our time. Once our personal connection to what is wrong becomes clear, then we have to choose. We can go on as before, recognizing our dishonesty and living with it the best we can, or we can begin the effort to change the way we think and live. The disease of the modern character is specialization. Looked at from the standpoint of the social system, the aim of specialization may seem desirable enough. The aim is to see that the responsibilities of government, law, medicine, engineering, agriculture, education, etc., are given into the hands of the most skilled, best prepared people. The difficulties do not appear until we look at specialization from the opposite standpoint, that of individual persons. We then begin to see the grotesquerie, indeed the impossibility, of an idea of community wholeness that divorces itself from any idea of personal wholeness. The first and best known hazard of the specialist system is that it produces specialists, people who are elaborately and expensively trained to do one thing. We get into absurdity very quickly here. There are, for instance, educators who have nothing to teach, communicators who have nothing to say, medical doctors skilled at expensive cures for diseases that they have no skill and no interest in preventing. More common and more damaging are the investors, manufacturers, and salesmen of devices who have no concern for the possible effects of those devices. Specialization is thus seen to be a way of institutionalizing, justifying, and paying highly for a calamitous disintegration and scattering out of the various functions of character, workmanship, care, conscience, responsibility. Even worse, a system of specialization requires the abdication to specialists of various competences and responsibilities that were once personal and universal. Thus, the average, one is tempted to say the ideal, American citizen, now consigns the problem of food production to agriculturalists and agribusinessmen, the problem of health to doctors and sanitation experts, the problem of education to school teachers and educators, the problems of conservation to conservationists, and so on. This supposedly fortunate citizen is therefore left with only two concerns: making money and entertaining himself. He earns money typically as a specialist, working an 8-hour day at a job for the quality or consequences of which somebody else, or perhaps more typically nobody else, will be responsible. And not surprisingly, since he can do so little else for himself, he's even unable to entertain himself, for there exists an enormous industry of exorbitantly expensive specialists whose purpose is to entertain him. The beneficiary of this regime of specialists ought to be the happiest of mortals, or so we are expected to believe. All of his vital concerns are in the hands of certified experts. He is a certified expert himself, and such he earns more money in a year than all his great-grandparents put together. But stints at his job he has nothing to do with, mow his lawn with a sit-down lawnmower, or watch other certified experts on television. At supper time he may eat a tray of ready-prepared food, which he and his wife, also a certified expert, procure at the cost only of money, transportation, and the pushing of a button. For a few minutes, between supper and sleep, he may catch a glimpse of his children, who since breakfast have been in the care of education experts, basketball or marching band experts, or perhaps legal experts. The fact is, however, that this is probably the most unhappy average citizen in the history of the world. He has not the power to provide himself with anything but money, and his money is inflating like a balloon and drifting away, subject to historical circumstances and the power of other people. From morning to night, he does not touch anything that he has produced himself, in which he can take pride. For all his leisure and recreation, he feels bad, he looks bad, he is overweight, his health is poor. His air, water, and food are all known to contain poisons. There's a fair chance that he will die of suffocation. He suspects that his love life is not as fulfilling as other people's. He wishes that he had been born sooner or later. He does not know why his children are the way they are. He does not understand what they say. He does not care much and does not know why he does not care. He does not know what his wife wants or what he wants. Certain advertisements and pictures in magazines make him suspect that he is basically unattractive. He feels that all his possessions are under threat of pillage. He does not know what he would do if he lost his job, if the economy failed, if the utility companies failed, if the police went on strike, if the truckers went on strike, if his wife left him, if his children ran away, if he should be found to be incurably ill. And for these anxieties, of course, he consults certified experts, who in turn consult certified experts about their anxieties. It is rarely considered that this average citizen is anxious because he ought to be, because he still has some gumption that he has not yet given up in deference to the experts. He ought to be anxious because he is helpless, that he is dependent upon so many specialists, the beneficiary of so much expert help, can only mean that he is a captive, a potential victim. If he lives by the competence of so many other people, then he lives also by their indulgence. His own will and his own reasons to live are made subordinate to the mere tolerance of everybody else. He has one chance to live what he conceives to be his life, his own small specialty within a delicate, tense, everywhere strained system of specialties. From a public point of view, the specialist system is a failure because, though everything is done by an expert, very little is done well. Our typical industrial or professional product is both ingenious and shoddy. The specialist system fails from a personal point of view because a person who can do only one thing can do virtually nothing for himself. In living in the world by his own will and skill, the stupidest peasant or tribesman is more competent than the most intelligent worker or technician or intellectual in a society of specialists. What happens under the rule of specialization is that, though society becomes more and more intricate, it has less and less structure. It becomes more and more organized, but less and less orderly. The community disintegrates because it loses the necessary understandings, forms, and enactments of the relations among materials and processes, principles and actions, ideals and realities, past and present, present and future, men and women, body and spirit, city and country, civilization and wilderness, growth and decay, life and death, just as the individual character loses the sense of a responsible involvement in these relations. No longer does human life rise from the earth like a pyramid, broadly and considerately founded upon its sources. Now it scatters itself out in a reckless horizontal sprawl, like a disorderly city whose suburbs and pavements destroy the fields. The concept of country, homeland, dwelling place, becomes simplified as the environment, that is, what surrounds us. Once we see our place, our part of the world, as surrounding us, we've already made a profound division between it and ourselves. We've given up the understanding, dropped it out of our language and so out of our thought, that we and our country create one another, depend on one another, are literally part of one another, that our land passes in and out of our bodies, just as our bodies pass in and out of our land, that as we and our land are part of one another, so all who are living as neighbors here, human and plant and animal, are part of one another, and so cannot possibly flourish alone. That, therefore, our culture must be our response to our place. Our culture and our place are images of each other and inseparable from each other, and so neither can be better than the other. Because, by definition, they lack any sense of mutuality or wholeness, our specializations subsist on conflict with one another. The rule is never to cooperate, but rather to follow one's own interest as far as possible. Checks and balances are all applied externally, by opposition, never by self-restraint. Labor, management, the military, the government, etc., never forbear until their excesses arouse enough opposition to force them to do so. The good of the whole of creation, the world and all its creatures together, is never a consideration because it is never thought of. Our culture now simply lacks the means for thinking of it. It is for this reason that none of our basic problems is ever solved. Indeed, it is for this reason that our basic problems are getting worse. The specialists are profiting too well from the symptoms, evidently, to be concerned about cures. Just as the myth of imminent cure, by some breakthrough of science or technology, is so lucrative and all-justifying as to foreclose any possibility of an interest in prevention. The problems thus become the stock in trade of specialists. The so-called professions survive by endlessly processing and talking about problems that they have neither the will nor the competence to solve. The doctor who is interested in disease but not in health is clearly in the same category with the conservationist who invests in the destruction of what he otherwise intends to preserve. They both have the comfort of job security, but at the cost of ultimate futility. One of the most troubling characteristics of the specialist mentality is its use of money as a kind of proxy, its willingness to transmute the powers and functions of life into money. Time is money is one of its axioms, and the source of many evils, among them, the waste of both time and money. Akin to the idea that time is money is the concept less spoken, but as commonly assumed, that we may be adequately represented by money. The giving of money has thus become our characteristic virtue. But to give is not to do. The money is given in lieu of action, thought, care, time, and it is no remedy for the fragmentation of character and consciousness that is the consequence of specialization. At the simplest, most practical level, it would be difficult for most of us to give enough in donations to good causes to compensate for, much less remedy, the damage done by the money that is taken from us and used destructively by various agencies of the government and by the corporations that hold us in captive dependence on their products. More important, if we could give enough to overbalance the official and corporate misuse of our money, we would still not solve the problem. The willingness to be represented by money involves a submission to the modern divisions of character and community. The remedy safeguards the disease. This has become, to some extent at least, an argument against institutional solutions. Such solutions necessarily fail to solve the problems to which they are addressed because, by definition, they cannot consider the real causes. The only real, practical, hope-giving way to remedy the fragmentation that is the disease of the modern spirit is a small and humble way, a way that a government or agency or organization or institution will never think of, though a person may think of it. One must begin in one's own life the private solutions that can only in turn become public solutions. If, for instance, one is aware of the abuses and extortions to which one is subjected as a modern consumer, then one may join in an organization of consumers to lobby for consumer protection legislation. But in joining a consumer organization, one defines oneself as a consumer merely, and a mere consumer is by definition a dependent, at the mercy of the manufacturer and the salesman. If the organization secures the desired legislation, then the consumer becomes the dependent not only of the manufacturer and salesman, but of the agency that enforces the law, and is at its mercy as well. The law enacted may be a good one, and the enforcers all honest and effective. Even so, the consumer will understand that one result of his effort has been to increase the number of people of whom he must beware. The consumer may proceed to organization and even to legislation by considering only his rights. And most of the recent talk about consumer protection has had to do with the consumer's rights. Very little indeed has been said about the consumer's responsibilities. It may be that whereas one rights may be advocated and even served by an organization, one's responsibilities cannot. It may be that when one hands one's responsibilities to an organization, one becomes, by that divestiture, irresponsible. It may be that the responsibility is intransigently a personal matter, that a responsibility can be fulfilled or failed, but cannot be got rid of. If a consumer begins to think and act in consideration of his responsibilities, then he vastly increases his capacities as a person. And he begins to be effective in a different way, a way that is smaller, perhaps, and certainly less dramatic, but sounder, and able sooner or later to assume the force of example. A responsible consumer would be a critical consumer, would refuse to purchase the less good, and he would be a moderate consumer. He would know his needs and would not purchase what he did not need. He would sort among his needs and study to reduce them. These things, of course, have been often said, though in our time they have not been said very loudly and have not been much heeded. In our time, the rule among consumers has been to spend money recklessly. People whose governing habit is the relinquishment of power, competence, and responsibility, and whose characteristic suffering is the anxiety of futility, make excellent spenders. They are the ideal consumers. By inducing in them little panics of boredom, powerlessness, sexual failure, mortality, paranoia, they can be made to buy, or vote for, virtually anything that is attractively packaged. The advertising industry is founded upon this principle. What has not been often said, because it did not need to be said until fairly recent times, is that the responsible consumer must also be in some way a producer. Out of his own resources and skills, he must be equal to some of his own needs. The household that prepares its own meals in its own kitchen with some intelligent regard for nutritional value, and thus depends on the grocer only for selected raw materials, exercises an influence on the food industry that reaches from the store all the way back to the seedsman. The household that produces some or all of its own food will have a proportionately greater influence. The household that can provide some of its own pleasures will not be helplessly dependent on the entertainment industry, will influence it by not being helplessly dependent on it, and will not support it thoughtlessly, out of boredom. The responsible consumer thus escapes the limits of his own dissatisfaction. He can choose and exert the influence of his choosing because he has given himself choices. He is not confined to the negativity of his complaint. He influences the market by his freedom. This is no specialized act, but an act that is substantial and complex, both practically and morally. By making himself responsibly free, a person changes both his life and his surroundings. It is possible, then, to perceive a critical difference between responsible consumers and consumers who are merely organized. The responsible consumer slips out of the consumer category altogether. He is a responsible consumer incidentally, almost inadvertently. He is a responsible consumer because he lives a responsible life. The same distinction is to be perceived between organized conservationists and responsible conservationists. A responsible consumer is, of course, a responsible conservationist. The conservationists who are merely organized function as specialists who have lost sight of basic connections. Conservation organizations hold stock in exploitative industries because they have no clear perception of, and therefore fail to be responsible for, the connections between what they say and what they do, what they desire, and how they live. The Sierra Club, for instance, defines itself by a slogan which it prints on the flaps of its envelopes. Its aim, according to the slogan, is to explore, enjoy, and protect the nation's scenic resources. To some extent, the club's current concerns and attitudes belie this slogan. There is also a sense in which the slogan defines the limits of organized conservation, some that have been self-imposed, others that are implicit in the nature of organization. The key word in the slogan is scenic. As used here, the word is a fossil. It is left over from a time when our comforts and luxuries were accepted simply as the rewards of progress to an ingenious, forward-looking people, when no threat was perceived in urbanization and industrialization, and when conservation was therefore an activity oriented toward vacations. It was good to get out of the city for a few weeks or weekends a year, and there was understandable concern that there should remain pleasant places to go. Some of the more adventurous vacationers were even aware of places of unique beauty that would be defaced if they were not set aside and protected. These people were effective in their way and within their limits, and they started the era of wilderness conservation. The results will give us abundant reasons for gratitude, as long as we have sense enough to preserve them. But wilderness conservation did little to prepare us either to understand or to oppose the general mayhem of the all-outdoors that the Industrial Revolution has finally imposed upon us. Wilderness conservation, we can now see, is specialized conservation. Its specialization is memorialized in the Sierra Club slogan, in the word scenic. A scene is a place as seen by a viewer. It is a view. The appreciator of a place perceived as scenic is merely its observer, by implication both different and distant or detached from it. The connoisseur of the scenic has thus placed strict limitations both upon the sort of place he is interested in and upon his relation to it. But even if the slogan were made to read, "To explore, enjoy, and protect the nation's resources," the most critical concern would still be left out. For while conservationists are exploring, enjoying, and protecting the nation's resources, they're also using them. They are drawing their lives from the nation's resources, scenic and unscenic. If the resolve to explore, enjoy, and protect does not create a moral energy that will define and enforce responsible use, then organized conservation will prove ultimately futile. And this, again, will be a failure of character. Although responsible use may be defined, advocated, and to some extent required by organizations, it cannot be implemented or enacted by them. It cannot be effectively enforced by them. The use of the world is finally a personal matter, and the world can be preserved in health only by the forbearance and care of a multitude of persons. That is, the possibility of the world's health will have to be defined in the characters of persons as clearly and as urgently as the possibility of personal success is now defined. Organizations may promote this sort of forbearance and care, but they cannot provide it.